This is United States v. Rudemekian. Once again, Judge Sparks is joining us by phone. Judge Sparks, are you there?
I am, sir.
And we have Senior Judge Efron serving as our fifth judge. Because of the procedural posture of this case, the government will argue first. And Major Morgan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government at this time?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
And Mr. Cade, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellee at this time? Very well. Please proceed.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Major Dustin Morgan, and I, along with Major Pamela Jones, represent the United States of America. Your Honor, I request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should reverse the Army Court and, in so doing, affirm appellee's findings and sentence. It's because the Army Court erred in applying a plain error standard of review to the question of whether Judge Henry was required to recuse himself. And in doing so, it improperly bypassed Judge Watkins, the post-trial 39A judge, ruling on appellee's post-trial motion for a mistrial. This court's precedent required the Army Court to grant the appropriate deference to Judge Watkins' ruling and determine whether or not he clearly abused his discretion when he determined a mistrial was not warranted in this case. The Army Court's failure to consider the post-trial proceedings also ignores this court's precedent in United States versus Martinez. In that case, is corresponding guidance regarding the third Liljeburg factor. Additionally, by not considering the post-trial remedial measures the Army took in appellee's trial, the Army Court did not conduct the appropriate analysis under the third Liljeburg factor, whether or not the public would lose confidence in the military justice system, given the particular circumstances of this case. The correct standard of review, whether or not Judge Watkins clearly abused his discretion, was not applied here, and in so doing, it's clear that he didn't. He didn't apply the wrong facts. He didn't apply the wrong law. And nothing that he did was unreasonable in his analysis. The counsel in this case that was discussed in the Army Court's opinion, Captain A.C., was not involved in this case. He was not the trial counsel. He was not the defense counsel. He was not stationed at the installation where appellee's court-martial took place. He was stationed over 200 miles away at a separate OSJ. There is nothing that links him to this case. Any strain that Judge Henry's improper conduct occurred had no bearing on this case. This is much more similar to the two cases that the Army Court upheld in analyzing Judge Henry's misconduct. It analyzed it in four other circumstances. In two cases, it affirmed, finding that there was no intolerable strain on the public's perception of the military justice system. And in both of those cases, we have similar facts and circumstances to here. Captain A.C. was not involved in the case. He didn't serve as a defense counsel or a trial counsel. He played no role in the proceedings. It was a separate OSJ, a different office of the staff judge advocate. The two cases where they reversed, Captain A.C. was directly involved. He was the trial counsel on one of the cases and the assistant trial counsel on the other case, thereby creating that perception problem that the third Liljeburg factor was meant to cure, was meant to provide a remedy for an accused that had an intolerable strain based upon their case by a judge who was required to recuse himself. Getting right off the bat to the recusal decision, this was not a decision that Judge Watkins needed to reach in his post-trial ruling for a mistrial, and it was not a decision that he did reach. And that's because United States v. Butcher allowed him to bypass that. In our brief, the government made clear that we're not conceding he should have recused himself for the factual circumstances that I talked about earlier. But even if he did, even assuming that he did, like Judge Watkins did in his post-trial ruling, in his post-trial analysis, none of the analysis that he did under Liljeburg was arbitrary, fanciful, clearly unreasonable, or clearly erroneous. He wasn't any of those things when he denied appellee's motion for a mistrial that occurred after the trial. His analysis concluded, members of the public understand that judges are not without fault, and given the lack of nexus between Captain A.C.'s family and the accused, a reasonable member of the public, knowing all the facts and the circumstances to include not only this unique relationship, but the sentence reduction, and the crux of the case as well, would not lose confidence in the justice system. That's a Joint Appendix 330. That's the proper analysis here. That takes into account exactly what United States versus Martinez says that the Army Court was supposed to do and what Judge Watkins was tasked to do in looking at the Liljeburg analysis and specifically the third prong. He took into account everything the Army did after appellee's court-martial was adjourned. And looking at that in a complete picture, there's nothing that the public would see that would cause them to lose any faith or confidence in the military justice system. Looking at those in total, Judge Henry did rule over the first post-trial 39A, and he reversed two of appellee's convictions because of this court's binding precedent at the time in United States v. Mangahouse. And in so doing, he reduced his sentence from 25 years to 17 years. After that, a separate military judge was appointed to examine particularly what was at issue in this case, to examine whether or not there was a problem raised by Judge Henry's improper relationship with Captain AC's spouse at the time. And in so doing, he held a post-trial 39A session that lasted for over 4 hours. It spans 150 pages of the record, which have all been included in the joint appendix, in which Captain AC was called and was able to point out all the particular intricacies of his relationship, the strain that it placed on him, and why he came forward to report Judge Henry's inappropriate conduct. He heard argument from both parties, and he made a detailed, thorough 9-page ruling that came a month after this post-trial 39A session. That's the complete picture here. That's what the Army Court ignored, and that's what this Court is required to look at, and required the Army Court to look at as well, quite frankly. And in so doing, there's nothing about that procedural posture, there's nothing about Judge Henry sitting on the case that called into question the fairness of Appellee's trial. It is a separate, unrelated captain who was not involved in this case whatsoever. There's no perception issue.
Counsel, may I ask two specific questions? One is the appellee suggests that we owe deference to the Army Court of Criminal Appeals because they've handled several cases involving Judge Henry. And I noticed you referenced some of those cases. So the first question is whether that's correct or not.
Your Honor, this Court's precedent, United States versus Shelton, United States versus Soroki, instruct that this Court passes through an intermediary appellate court when looking at a military judge's decision. So I cite those only as an example of why Judge Watkins didn't abuse his discretion, not because of any deference that this Court owes the Army Court.
Second question is, we have applied the Liljeburg factors on appeal. Is there anything improper about Judge Watkins' decision to apply them in the first instance in deciding whether there should be a mistrial?
I mean, that's what makes this case unique from the three cases in particular where this Court has applied Liljeburg. Because of the procedural posture of the case, because it happened post-trial, and because there was an intermediary judge appointed to examine this at that stage, Liljeburg is the proper analysis. If a recusal decision was to be made, there needs to be a remedy analysis. There needs to be something that comes after, and Liljeburg is the only test to apply according to this Court's precedent. So it was not error for him to do that, Your Honor.
Do you have any precedents you could cite from the Article III or civilian courts as to whether if a judge decides that recusal is required, then applying the Liljeburg factors to that?
At the trial level, Your Honor?
At the trial level, if you have a second judge come in.
Your Honor, I did examine that issue, and I could not find an example in the civilian federal courts or the state courts, even for that matter, where a trial judge came in and made an intermediary decision. This appears to be an issue of first impression on this.
You referred to the actions of the trial judge during the first post-trial session in dismissing two of the charges because there was a binding precedent. In that context, does the action of the trial judge cut one way or another on any of the Liljeburg factors, the fact that he dismissed those charges when there was a binding precedent?
Your Honor, it's not so much the dismissal, it's the actual sentence reassessment and the fact that he did reduce the sentence when asked by appellee. And that cuts, honestly, that cuts more towards the first Liljeburg factor, which both the Army Court and neither appellee or the appellant in this case argue are at issue here.
In the record, it reflects that the defense objected to the proceeding, objected to using a proceeding in revision rather than a reconsideration or a rehearing on the sentence. How does that cut as far as the Liljeburg factors go, that the defense objection was rejected?
Your Honor, again, the procedural posture of this case is quite different. There was a second intermediary judge that was appointed to re-examine that issue. Judge Nance was appointed second in the post-trial posture, and he examined that particular issue, whether a mistrial was the more appropriate remedy given the issue that U.S. versus Manga House created. And he also rejected
That's not what I was referring to, so I'll try to, but my question may not have been clear. During the first proceeding, the military judge, who's the subject of the recusal, said that he was going to conduct a proceeding and revision. The defense objected to that, not requesting a mistrial at that point, but requesting either that there be a reconsideration or a hearing on the sentence at that time there. And so how does that cut on the Liljeburg factors that the judge rejected that request from the defense?
Yeah,
as far as whether the actions of the judge on the sentencing show a degree of impartiality.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand now. My apologies.
No, I was not clear, so thank you for letting me clear that up.
So eventually he did deny the complete hearing revision, but he did hear from Appelli on sentence again. Appelli was presented the opportunity to reopen the sentence, the pre-sentencing proceedings almost, and was allowed to argue for an appropriate sentence. So while it potentially could cut against in the first standard, and whether or not there was actual bias or not, I just don't think that that's an issue here looking at the trial as a whole.
And one last follow-up on that. In terms of the sentence itself, and correct me if I've not correctly read the record, but it appears that the defense requested a sentence of 5 to 8 years, that the government requested a sentence of 20 years, and the judge gave a sentence of 17 years, which numerically closer to the government's point. Is there anything in the record that would indicate whether the judge who conducted the third hearing, the one on the issue of whether there should have been a recusal and the consequence of it, did the judge take that into account? Is there anything in which to show that the judge looked at the sentence requests and determine how that might have a bearing under the Liljeburg factors?
Your Honor, it does not appear that the judge, the third judge, Judge Watkins, particularly considered that individual facet, but he was clear on the record and he was clear in his ruling that he did examine the entire record. I will note that it was a reduction from 25 years to 17 years upon sentence reassessment for losing two specifications of rape. And the charges in whole do speak of a rather serious crime, so the sentence does appear to be appropriate given the vastness of the record. So while he doesn't say that particularly, he is clear that he did view the entire record, Your Honor. And again, he found that Liljeburg Factor 1 and 2 were not at issue here.
Thank you.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions for counsel?
No, thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Cave.
Good morning, may it please the court. Philip Cave, along with Jonathan Potter and Captain Britt, on behalf of Appelli, Major Rudemetkin. The government does not concede that Judge Henry should have recused himself. That is their message to the members of the public. That is their message to other military judges, trial counsel, defense counsel, and army judge advocates about this case. So when a military mom comes up to a trial counsel and says, well, didn't he violate RCM 902? No, ma'am, we don't concede he did. That's their response here. Judge Maggs, I will address in a moment your question about the deference to ACCA. And Judge, this is so stupid. F1. The answer is no.
At my age, sometimes I have to look at the identification to remember who I am as well.
I got it, Your Honor. The answer is no to your question about the federal courts. And actually, the amicus has done most of the work for us on those particular issues and how this has been addressed in federal courts. If I may, I would refer you to some of their brief about how 902 is dealt with under 28 U.S.C. 445 Alpha. because there are a number of things that come from that which clearly are appropriate here. So anyway,
Counsel, you discussed the question of whether the government should have done more than simply take the position that assuming that there was a recusal. Is there any requirement in this the context of this litigation for the government to do so? That does that affect our analysis one way or another if the government either concedes that there was a requirement for recusal or takes the position that assuming that recusal was required? Does that litigation determination by the government affect our analysis?
Yes, it goes right to the third Lilleberg factor, public perception. And the Army judge advocates are part of the public. And that's the message we're sending to the public, as well as the military moms and dads and spouses and families. So with respect, Your Honor, yes, it does affect the Lilleberg analysis. keep in mind also, and you were asking about the other issues of prejudice that Judge Watkins did or did not, but Major Rudomatkin didn't get a fully informed forum choice here because he didn't know about the potential for disqualification. So that may or may not be a factor when it comes to your final analysis.
Is that issue identified in the briefs in this case or otherwise in the record, that the failure to recuse at the time of forum choice was a matter of prejudice?
Not directly, Your Honor, but it is certainly inferred and can be inferred from the whole record going back to a very lengthy record of trial and a lot of filings with the courts, including this one. excuse me. The Army Court did review Appellee's case for an abuse of discretion. It just happens that they wrote more on the plain error analysis. And frankly, we agree. You should review Appellee's case or the issue for an abuse of discretion. In doing so, you should apply the objective, the reasonable member of the public test. This court said that before Butcher. This court said that in Butcher. And this court has said that in other cases up until Uribe. Sullivan and Uribe. Where this court reached out for the arbitrary, and if I may say it this way, arbitrary and capricious test. That's my way of shortening the phrase, if you will. But again, and this is where, if I may again refer to Amicus Brief, that's the practice in federal court. And why not follow in a similar fashion how the federal courts dispose of this issue? Without deference to the, in those instances, deference to the judge who himself or herself is being asked to recuse. But why not do that? And when it comes to...
Counsel, again, turning to this litigation in this case,
yeah.
I understand your point now. Has the defense asked for the application of that theory to this case, or is the defense resting on an abuse of discretion analysis? Or something else?
We are agreeing that abuse of discretion is the standard of review to court. Yes. Am I answering the question?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, yeah. A lot of thought goes into ending up in this room. if I may, this case is the wrong case to apply Uribe and Sullivan and the arbitrary and capricious test, or Yes, test. For this reason. You got three boxes. Box one has United States versus Brown. Brown was a case where the issue was the mode of presentation of the witness. Brown used, this court in Brown brought up the arbitrary and capricious test, which this court cited in Uribe and in Sullivan. In other words, it adopted the Brown test. That's from box one. Box one contains a judge abusing his or her discretion on a motion or an evidentiary rule, a challenge to a member, even a continuance. So that's a category in a box, if you will. A second box is Uribe and others. The judge has, in most of the cases, I won't say all, personal interactions with the counsel. That's where this frequently comes up. And that's where we get this whole thing about where the military is not an isolated society, all those kind of things. But it's disclosed. The judge puts it out on the record, especially these days. It's like, well, counsel, I know him, and it's a lengthy recitation of the judge's service. That's box two. And it's probably not unreasonable in box one, at least from our perspective, to say, let's look at this from an arbitrary and capricious perspective. And maybe so for a box two. But this is box one. Secretive. Undisclosed. Misconduct of the judge himself.
That's generally true about misconduct.
Oh, absolutely, but it's...
I'm a little confused about the rule that you want us to articulate in this case. So I think you're going to say, and maybe you can help me out. So here, the military judge abused his discretion by failing to declare a mistrial in a case where what? What is the general rule? So if you win, and some poor Westlaw attorney is going to have to go write a head note that says, in this factual circumstance, it was an abuse of discretion for the military judge to fail to rule for a mistrial. What is the generalized circumstance that, in this case, it was an abuse of discretion for the military judge not to order a mistrial?
Because in some cases, the error or the underlying problems can be so severe that we cannot be certain that the public perception will be satisfied with the result. And that's the third Lilleberg. There have been situations where, excuse me, no actual prejudice. You don't need actual prejudice under the third Lilleberg factor. I agree it's preferable. But that's what we're looking for. We're asking you to come to the conclusion.
And I know where you're going with this. So how do we get there, right? Maybe the military judge had parking tickets, unpaid parking tickets. That's misconduct. Right. Would that have been grounds for a mistrial? But I'm going to guess you're going to say no. Maybe he had been engaged in an affair with one of the participants in the trial before him. That's misconduct. That's clearly grounds for a mistrial, at least in my opinion. But we're somewhere in between parking tickets and having an affair with the counsel in the case. So how do we know where to draw that line when things go from not requiring a mistrial to requiring a mistrial? Or at least in this case, where it was a abuse of discretion for the military judge to decide that this case fell on one side of that line versus the other.
Well, I would agree that each of the people that your example you used, the judge is messing with people involved in the trial. And so I agree that when the government says, well, the captain was not involved in this case, that sort of thing. I don't think you should... We don't think you should make that specific of a distinction in this kind of situation where the risk is to the overall fairness of the trial and the perception of the overall fairness. And one of the things at JA 244, the defense is making reference to a federal court, Bracey v. Schoemaker, where they talk about the issue is, and I was going to discuss this in the sense of split verdicts as much as anything else, where the idea of compensatory bias comes up. In other words, the judge will rule or do things in a particular way because he or she is trying to compensate to avoid being discovered or their delicts being disclosed, those kind of things. And it's interesting because there was something similar in Quintanilla where the court makes reference to the judge acting in a fashion to compensate for the appearance of any potential bias, where he bends over backwards to make it seem as though he's not acted as a result of such bias. Well, that goes to the split verdict, and I know they didn't bring it up, but I suspect you yourselves will think about the split verdict because it came up in the sense of the revision issue later. Just because this is a split verdict should not make as much difference in this case than it might in others. And keep in mind, the one factor different from the other Army cases is the charge sheet. And that's certainly one of the central factors that the Army Court focused on as to why this case was different than the other Army cases, the other Henry cases, the group of Henry cases. And so, Judge Max, deference to the Army Court. No, there's no law. The law doesn't say we shall or we will defer to the Army Court. But the point here is, I think, again from the third Lilburg factor, public perception. As we said in our brief, all the judges of the Army Court were involved in one or more of the Henry cases, some of which are reported, some are unreported, either because they were on a panel deciding a case, and we laid out in our brief the connections, and ultimately en banc. They were en banc, and a majority, at least a majority, that's the Army rule, were not willing to vote for en banc reconsideration. That's what I mean by deferring to the Army Court. In other words, they have the big picture. Judge Watkins didn't have the big picture. He was dealing with one case. He wasn't thinking about the other cases. And if I recollect correctly, in his written findings, he doesn't refer to any other cases because it wasn't brought up. He didn't have the big picture. Now, I don't say that in a way to disparage Judge Watkins, but that's the issue here. And he didn't really analyze the case from the perspective of what charges Major Ruder Metkin was facing. And I agree it's the adultery or the allegations of adultery compared to the alleged misconduct at the time of Judge Henry. So there are two areas there in Judge Watkins' ruling that we take issue with and we think you should take issue with. And that's the big picture.
Can you be more specific? I'm still worried about my friend at Westlaw. So, here, the military judge did not, it was at least my understanding of the facts, is he was not found to have committed adultery. He had an improper and possibly unethical relationship with someone. Now, the appellee in this case was charged with adultery, which is why I think you referenced the charge sheet a few moments ago. So but maybe there was an allegation of adultery originally for the military judge. Is that the nexus that you're trying to draw between the misconduct and the charges that the appellee was facing that demonstrates here that the military judge A should have recused himself, but even assuming, even if he didn't, that a mistrial is required, because you have a situation where a judge was being accused of behavior that is the same as the behavior that the defendant in front of him in the court-martial was being charged with. Is that the general rule that you think applies to this case that tells us why the military judge abused his discretion in not declaring a mistrial?
Not just me, Your Honor, but the Army Court of Criminal Appeals.
But no offense, but they're not here.
I agree with you, Judge, and I don't mean to be coy or glib with you.
Now, in that circumstance, does it matter that my understanding of the facts is the military judge was found not to have committed adultery?
According to what is in the record, the 15-6 validated an ongoing inappropriate relationship, which had, if you look at the timeline, at the time of appellant's trial, arguably reached, I'll say an apogee, that may be wrong, but a high intensity, shall I say it that way. But yes, based on the record, what's in the record? That's what the 15-6 found.
So does that matter? Does it matter that they, to us, I understand your point that he was accused of adultery at least, and that the appellee was facing an adultery charge, and therefore that's the nexus. Does it make any difference that the military judge was found, we'll just say not guilty is not really the right word, but they found that he did not commit adultery? Or that it had not been proved. I'm not really sure what the standard review there is, but that they did not find that he had committed adultery. Should that matter to our analysis about how meaningful that nexus between the two factual circumstances is?
Again, without meaning to be glib, between you and me, yes, it's a factor, but not to the member of the public. The members of the public looking at this, and everybody else who's not had the benefit of reading hundreds of pages of paper, they're not able and probably won't make those fine distinctions. And again, we ourselves as lawyers, we have this problem frequently. As lawyers, we're able to think things through and make fine distinctions, sometimes correctly and sometimes wrong, or sometimes we're out to lunch. But it's, if the issue is, what does Sergeant Smith, a potential accused, think? Or Petty Officer Jones's mother and the rest of the members of the public? What do they think? I guess I should limit to Sergeant Jones.
An analogous question is when we consider whether or not there's the appearance of UCI. And there we consider what a fully informed member of the public thinks. Would not a similar standard here apply? A fully informed member of the public would know that the military judge was found not to have committed adultery?
I understand the point, and that's not an unreasonable approach. But again, we're getting to fine distinctions. And that the UCI approach, works, more from a big picture, but once you get down to the nitty-gritty, these fine distinctions, I don't think the public gets it or does in their own minds make those fine distinctions that we as lawyers.
I see that your time has expired. Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
I do not, Chief.
Any questions from the bench?
Thank you,
Mr. Kidd. Captain Morgan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Hardy, I want to start with where we left off. I think your standard is right, a fully informed member of the public. And I appellee characterizes this as a fine distinction, but it's a general overall way to look at this. Judge Henry was not found by a preponderance of the evidence by Judge Watkins to have committed adultery. Appelli was convicted of three different specifications under one charge of adultery, one of which also involved a violent offense, another one also involved sexual acts that were tied into one of the rapes he was convicted of. These are very different, categorically different, on a whole other point. A fully informed member of the public would at least know that, Your Honor. They would at least be aware of that. These are two vastly distinct and different things. And I want to next go to a quote in the United States versus Bush.
Counsel, before you do that, could you respond to counsel for the appellee's point that the judges on the Army Court of Criminal Appeals, including all the judges on banc, that they are members of the public, and indeed they are fully informed, and yet they saw this differently from Judge Watkins?
Your Honor, the Army Court did not hear this case en banc.
They declined to hear it en banc.
They did, Your Honor, and we can draw no inference from that, whether or not they disagreed with Judge Watkins or not. And I will point out the United States versus Weeks tells us that a mere difference of opinion is not enough to show an abuse of discretion. They could disagree with Judge Watkins, but they didn't analyze Judge Watkins, Your Honor. Appelli points out that they referenced abuse of discretion. They do so in a footnote, in one line. And they don't reference anything that Judge Watkins does in his 9-page findings of fact and conclusions of law. That's not the analysis that he's owed under United States v. Commisso. Like, it's more than that. They need to actually look at what he did.
Counsel, you've mentioned that a number of times. Under what principle of law would we find that the court's footnote regarding abuse of discretion did not reflect that they looked at all of these matters and reached conclusions on those matters?
Your Honor, it's a sliding scale of deference, and the more analysis they put into it, the more deference that it's owed. Scant analysis is owed almost no deference.
So that if for example, the Court of Criminal Appeals used the same language in a case that was adverse to the accused. They decided on a completely different principle and said, but we would also find on abuse of discretion, and the opinion itself contains no analysis on abuse of discretion. And the case works its way into the Article III courts where you'd have the standard of full and fair consideration. At the Article III courts, let's assume that the government is not able to defend the court's ruling on the other theory and wants to rely totally on abuse of discretion. What would the government say if the defendant in that case, the petitioner in a collateral review, said, Article III court, you can't pay any attention to what that Court of Criminal Appeals said because they just put this in a footnote and didn't discuss things at all? Would the government say, that's right, we lose?
And I see him out of time.
Please answer the question.
The government would say this is the same thing, that it's a sliding scale of deference, and scant analysis requires little to no deference.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is now submitted. Court thanks counsel for both sides. Court stands adjourned until further order of the court.